Nemoto presents Addiction, Naming the Hunger. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 14 minutes. Addiction often begins in silence, creeping into households and histories without a clear warning. For generations it lived behind closed doors and careful smiles, a subject traded in whispers and euphemism. Yet the reality has been constant across centuries and borders. Addiction has shaped human experience in every society. It has never been confined to one class, one culture, or one substance. It threads through stories of alcohol and opium, nicotine and cocaine, gambling dens and glowing screens. The forms change, but the human struggle remains. Across time, authorities tried to name it. Moralists described vice, doctors cataloged symptoms, courts punished infractions, and reformers promised cures. Each lens issued part of the picture and then insisted upon the whole. A more complete view emerged slowly, recognizing that addiction is not a single spark but a weather system. Biology, psychology, and society converge. Personal history and public policy collide. In one neighborhood, addiction might wear the face of a bottle, in another, the click of a slot machine, in a third, the soft light of an endless feed. Beneath the many faces sits a recurring motive: relief sought from pain, meaning sought amid emptiness, control sought in chaos. Medicine once framed addiction as a defect of character. Later, it was cast as a disease of the brain. The modern synthesis treats it as a condition of the whole person. Biological adaptations set inside emotional landscapes and social conditions. Brains adapt under the pressure of repeated exposure, but those adaptations rarely arise in a vacuum. Trauma lowers thresholds, stress erodes inhibitions, isolation intensifies craving, and scarcity teaches short-term survival at the expense of long-term health. In that sense, addiction is less a single event than a pattern that installs itself in a life, making itself useful at first and then indispensable, until the cost outweighs the comfort and the pattern refuses to relinquish its place. The earliest phase often looks ordinary. A drink at the end of a difficult day, a pill after an injury, a thrill found at a card table, an hour stolen for escape. In moderation, these are familiar rituals. Relief arrives, tensions ease, sleep comes, and the mind returns to ordinary tasks. Over time, the ritual calls for a larger share of attention. Tolerance builds. The same dose no longer produces the same effect, and repetition compensates for diminished returns. Soon absence hurts more than presence helps. Withdrawal announces itself in tremors and sleeplessness, irritability and despair. What once created pleasure now prevents pain. The ritual that promised control becomes a tyrant that demands fealty. Biology explains part of the shift. The brain's reward circuitry rests on networks that once tied survival to motivation. Food, attachment, achievement, and curiosity brought measured pulses of satisfaction that encouraged repetition. Powerful substances and behaviors hijacked this circuitry, delivering atypical intensity. In response, the system recalibrates. Receptors downregulate, baselines sink, natural pleasures register as faint echoes, and cues linked to the substance acquire outsized importance. A street corner, the smell of a bar, a time on a clock, the texture of cash, the feeling of boredom or rage, any of these can become a trigger that fires before conscious choice arrives. The prefrontal regions, built to weigh consequences and hold goals in mind, lose influence precisely when needed most. Insight survives, but impulse cements action. The mind that plans change is not the mind that decides at the moment of temptation. Psychology offers another layer. Addiction rarely arrives in an empty life. It settles where hurts and hungers are already present. Early neglect, household violence, unstable caregiving, and chronic humiliation leave imprints that shape coping. Loss, illness, and unprocessed trauma place a constant demand on nervous systems already overburdened. In such conditions, substances and compulsive behaviors function like improvised tools, blunting memories, softening grief, quieting worry, simulating triumph, or supplying companionship. The tool quickly becomes identity. The person who drank to sleep becomes someone who cannot sleep without drinking. The person who gambled to feel alive becomes someone who cannot feel alive without risk. The person who overused pain medicine to heal becomes someone sustained by the medicine rather than by healing. The line between strategy and prison blurs until it disappears. Society completes the picture. A city with easy credit and predatory lending will produce one pattern of addiction. A rural county with shuttered factories and cheap liquor will produce another. A port where heroin arrives faster than jobs will produce a third. Laws govern supply and shape stigma. Housing and wages govern stability and stress. Healthcare access governs how early a problem is addressed and how long help lasts. In many jurisdictions, incarceration answered addiction for decades, but cells did not cure despair. The cycle hardened. Arrest, withdrawal, release, relapse, repeat. In other places, public health approaches, clinic-based care, medication support, safe use supplies, housing-first policies, replaced some of the punitive reflexes. The places that chose health spent money on treatment rather than jail beds and saw predictable results. Fewer funerals, fewer infections, more reunions. Stigma sits at the center of policy and care alike. Labels compress lives into caricature. Addict, junkie, drunk. Each shuts a door that could have opened onto help. Shame thrives on silence and keeps families isolated until a crisis forces exposure. When shame recedes, curiosity becomes possible. Questions change shape. What relief did the habit provide at the start? What was it protecting? What wound does it cover? Who stands ready to help if asked? The answers rarely absolve harm but often guide repair. Curiosity also widens the circle of responsibility. Instead of treating addiction as a private failure requiring private correction, communities begin to see obligations in public space. Predictable shelters, low-barrier clinics, childcare during appointments, enough counselors to answer the phone the day someone finally decides to call. Language matters because attention is finite. Stories focused solely on catastrophe exhaust compassion and hide the many recoveries unfolding quietly. In neighborhoods with active peer networks, the story sounds different. A father attending school concerts again, a nurse returning to practice through a monitored program, a carpenter completing an apprenticeship with medication support, a grandmother raising grandchildren while a daughter stabilizes. Each narrative records ordinary victories that add up to renewed trust, steadier payrolls, and lighter dockets. Each also demonstrates a principle that often goes unsaid. Recovery is not an act but a system of people, routines, and places that makes good decisions easier and bad decisions less fatal. Harm reduction is sometimes described as conceding to vice. In practice, it is the grammar of survival. Clean syringes reduce infections. Overdose reversal medication prevents deaths that would end all other efforts. Supervised consumption rooms move crises from alleys into clinical spaces where oxygen and empathy are available. These interventions do not require perfection to justify themselves. They require only the recognition that breathing bodies can return to clinics and families. Non-breathing bodies cannot. In cities that embrace harm reduction, relationships form between staff and people who once trusted no one. When readiness for change appears, there is a known doorway rather than a leap into the dark. Treatment strategies vary because people vary. Medication-assisted treatment stabilizes brain chemistry in opioid use disorder and alcohol use disorder, reducing cravings and blocking euphoria. Critics mistake stabilization for surrender, but long-term medication is considered standard for diabetes and hypertension. Addiction deserves the same pragmatism. Behavioral therapies help patients notice the moment when a thought becomes an urge and an urge becomes an act, breaking the chain with pauses and substitutions. Mindfulness practices teach the nervous system to tolerate discomfort without reflexive flight to a substance. Family-based approaches repair relationships and rewrite patterns that pull everyone back toward crisis. Creative arts therapies lend shape to memories that resist ordinary language and help dignity return after years of secrecy and shame. No single technique heals a life. Warmth, structure, and time do. Morning routines that are honored whether or not mood cooperates. Meetings attended on rain-slick evenings when excuses present themselves like gifts. Meals prepared on Sundays so that Mondays do not collapse. Phones moved across the room before sleep so that late-night spirals lose momentum. Bills opened instead of stored in a drawer. Apologies delivered in full sentences and accepted without theater. Each ordinary act becomes a stitch in a fabric that addiction once tore. Relapse complicates the narrative of transformation. Many interpret a slip as proof that nothing changed. A more useful frame treats it as information. Which trigger was underestimated, which hour was most vulnerable, which support was missing. Programs that welcome people back without moral grandstanding shorten the interval between relapse and return. Shorter intervals translate into fewer lost jobs, fewer ruptured relationships, and fewer funerals. In this sense, kindness is not sentiment but strategy. Addiction distorts time. Immediate relief seems immense, while distant consequences shrink. Recovery restores scale. Anniversaries mark re-expanded futures, but so do quiet milestones. A full night of sleep, an unremarkable Tuesday, a laugh that arrives without permission, the return of ordinary boredom that no longer frightens. These are neurological events as much as sentimental ones. The reward system learns again to register modest pleasures and stop chasing extremes. Culture carries heavy influence. Films and headlines can humanize or caricature. A mugshot turns a person into a problem. A profile that includes work, family, and recovery turns a person back into a neighbor. Employers exercise similar power. A company that offers leave and a return-to-work pathway signals that help is for the valued, not just for the condemned. Schools that teach emotional regulation and media literacy reduce risk years before any substance is offered. Courts that channel eligible defendants to treatment change public safety more than extra patrols do. Faith communities and civic clubs create belonging that outlasts resolutions made on January mornings. Every layer counts because every layer either accelerates a spiral or breaks it. The arts offer something medicine sometimes forgets: rehearsal for new lives. In rooms where scripts are practiced and songs are shared, people try on refusal, apology, boundary setting, and celebration. They build muscles needed outside the rehearsal space. Speaking truth, accepting feedback, staying present when discomfort rises. Group creation bonds participants to each other and offers joy that does not demand a chemical key. In programs that integrate art with clinics, retention improves because hope returns and forms beyond charts and lab values. None of this erases the severity of harm. Communities grieve through waves of overdose, families fracture under the weight of secrecy and fear, and individuals lose years to a pattern that began as comfort. The ledger must be read honestly. Yet an honest ledger also shows the scale of repair when help is present. Nervous systems quiet. Minds learn alternatives. Bodies regain strength. Neighborhoods add supports that prevent crisis rather than responding to it. A society that recognizes addiction clearly invests in possibilities instead of punishments, and the dividends are visible not in speeches but in school attendance, clinic logs, payrolls, and dinner tables filled again. The coming years promise continued debate. Some will call for harsher statutes, others for regulated markets, others for treatment on demand. Beneath policy arguments lies a simpler choice. What kind of neighbor is imagined when the subject of addiction arises? If imagined as a threat, banishment follows and the cycle repeats. If imagined as a person in trouble, structures appear that welcome, stabilize, and expect the best without denying the worst. Outcomes track those imaginations with unnerving fidelity. The story of addiction, seen whole, is not merely a tale of collapse. It is a record of return. It is the inventory of decisions, individual and collective, that widen or narrow the path back. No single clinic, statute, or sermon will suffice. But a sustained combination, clear information, warm reception, practical supports, patient time, builds a civic immune system that resists despair. In places where that immune system is strong, addiction loosens its grip. Where it is weak, despair spreads. The difference is chosen. This series will move from foundations to history, from policy to practice, from collapse to reconstruction. The first task has been to replace caricature with context. The next is to examine the long arc by which intoxicants became sacred tools, household remedies, imperial commodities, and finally, objects of modern regulation. By understanding how the past arranged the present, communities gain leverage over the future they will build.